This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, we'll call this meeting to order. This is the Employee Assembly meeting for Wednesday, May 19th, 2010. It is 12:17 p.m., and we are meeting in B16 Day Hall. Jason Kilmore, Chair. And we're going to do the call the roll call. David Brooks.
Here.
Pempa Dungtow.
Here.
Tanya Grove.
Here.
Linda Kroll Howell.
Here.
Ned LaSalle has some work obligations and cannot make it today. Leon Lawrence.
He said he was coming over at 20 this morning.
Okay. Alan Mittman. Leslie Morris.
Here.
Gemma Osborne.
Here.
Tim Ostrander.
Here.
Keely Phillips.
Here.
Jason Seymour, present. Gary Stewart.
Here.
Beth McKinney, our employee elected trustee, was not able to join us at the onset. She may be able to reach the tail end of the meeting. One ex officio members, Mary George Opperman, will be present later today. Ben Heavener, GPSA.
I'm here.
Our GPSA liaison. And from the Office of Assemblies, we have Ari Epstein, who's out making copies, Amy O'Donnell, and Nancy Doolittle from the Chronicle. And our newly elected Employee Assembly members, if you'd like to introduce yourself. Is she one of them?
No.
No? Just sitting. Okay. Thank you.
You know, over the years, I've tried to figure out a way to come and just eat and leave before they ask me questions. All right.
Good.
Good to see you.
Hi,
everybody.
Over here, you guys want me to eat or drink if you'd like?
Yeah, just talk with you guys.
Okay. Is Marion the same with you, or is she coming down here?
She'll be here soon, I think. I'm just having a while today.
You guys have had me.
Yeah, we haven't had a while day since yesterday.
Yeah,
really.
Hi, how's it going?
And of course, our guest today, President David Scorton, has just joined us, and we'll just wait a few seconds here for Mary to arrive, and then we'll get started.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. That'd be great.
David, how is Qatar? Can you tell us about the trip to the Middle East?
Yeah, sure will. Let's grab something to drink. We'll have something to drink for you guys.
How have you been doing?
Good.
Busy.
Hey, Mary. Next chair, we should
have. No, I just walked in about 1 nanosecond ago.
Well, I'm sorry, you're late.
Just like a sneak in ahead of you.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Because this room's gonna get
hot. So I think Jason's not gonna eat, so we can just get going.
Oh, okay.
But Mary wants to have.
I brought my. Mood lighting.
Yeah.
That's well, they're blaring.
Sorry, you
want
to sit up first? You sure? Okay.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. This our special guest today for Business of the Day is President David Scorton and VP of Human Resources, Mary George Opperman. So welcome. We've submitted some questions in advance, but I guess so let's just get started with an open discussion, or I'll turn the floor over to you to...
I just have one or two very brief things to say. Mary, just before you walked in, Gary was asking if I could just say something about the commencement of Qatar just because I got back. And it was very nice. It was the third commencement. There were 17 graduates. This is the first time that there were more men than women graduating. It's a very interesting feature of the cultural difference in that particular part of the world and in that country, that it's still hard for women to see their way clear to travel alone to an international country and get an education overseas. And many reasons for that that are not unique, but are related to the culture and the family structure. And one of the reasons that the royal family developed these courses right in Doha was so that both men and women would have access to the kind of education at the graduate as well as undergraduate level that normally you would travel to the U.S. or the U.K. or Australia to get. And it's interesting that depending on the portion of our graduate student population you look at, some of our programs, 50% of the students in graduate studies and PhD programs, between 40-50% are international students. Mm-hmm. And undergraduate is less, but we're one of the most international universities. But some families cannot see their way clear to send a student literally around the world. Mm-hmm. And then there's this additional gender-related thing. So it's been overwhelmingly women in the programs the first 2 years, and this is the first year there were a couple more men and women. So that was interesting, and I had a chance to talk with the students about that a little bit. And they did well in the residency management program. A few of them are going to be coming here to New York and elsewhere. So it was real, real heartwarming. I always love commencements, but the best part of this one for me is interacting with the families, the brothers and sisters and parents, because it's such a change in what's available. I feel so bad when I read it. It's such a change for what's been available to them. And the only part of it, it's not a downside, but the only part of it that constantly bothers me is that we're not really changing the higher education structure in the country. They've imported 6 turnkey university campuses, you know, Georgetown and all these other places, and their own universities don't benefit from this, right? There's just competition to those universities. And other models that Cornell is involved with in Africa and elsewhere, the emphasis is actually in building up the capacity of a local institution so that, you know, one day if the American or UK partner decides I'm not going to stay here, there'll still be increased capacity. So it was a very, very positive visit. And it was wonderful. I'm trying to learn more and more about the culture in Islamic countries. I said hello for about 10 years. And the students who were there and their families were very willing and open to talk with me about that. I learned a lot. It was fantastic. And those same 17 students come to as many of them as can get there, come to New York City for the regular commencement of the medical school because it is part of the medical school. And so I'll be shaking their hands, walking across the stage on June 2nd, I think is the date of the commencement. And when I say shaking their hands, sometimes you don't shake hands. So I've learned a lot about the culture. Also, I give the beginning of my speech in Arabic. I've been studying Arabic for a month or units here, and I'm up to about the level of a one-year-old. So I'm the level I can sort of walk now and say goo-goo and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And each time I go there, I try to impress some of the leading people there. And the first year I went, they said, oh, are you trying to learn Arabic? The second year, they said, keep practicing your Arabic. Keep working on it. And this year, I got all the way up to, how's your Arabic coming? So I've come all the way from basically you really don't know what you're saying at all, what were you trying to say, all the way to I think he said Papa or something like that. Anyway, it was great. It was fun. The one thing I wanted to say before I answer to whatever questions you have is how much I tell you this every time I meet it from the heart, how much I appreciate what you and the staff standing behind you have been through, and how helpful, strong, and collectively, how much you're helping to change the university. And I realize uncertainties and scariness of the situation when there's layoffs and the threat of layoffs. And I appreciate the huge good counsel from staff around the university. And I try, but I know I don't spend enough time making it clear how much I appreciate it. So I'm ready to take questions.
Okay. Do you want to sit here so you can see everyone?
No. I like coming to sit. Keeps me young.
Meeting is a flash of drugs.
Okay. I guess we'll jump into some of our questions here. It says, as a performer yourself, what do you feel are the role of the performing arts at Cornell, especially considering the devastating cuts facing the Department of Theater, Film, and Dance?
So, you know, I say it's important to me, and it is important to me that we have robust humanities and arts departments. This is a tough time for the university, and I always want to be as straightforward and honest with everybody as I possibly can be. Overall, things cannot stay the same in the university as they always have been, because we're in a different budget world, and it's not going to go away completely. So we have to change how we look at many things in the university. Having said that, the importance of our support of the arts and humanities is very, very high on my list and on the list of the university leadership. Is there any evidence of that? Yes, we're building Paul Milstein Hall. Yes, we've invested money in all kinds of programs in the arts and humanities. As far as I know, all of the departments and all of the programs in arts and sciences are undergoing difficult questions about whether it's possible to keep those programs going with less money. Everything in the university is stretched now. There's fewer staff. And as Mary always points out very accurately and wisely, we haven't yet reduced the amount of work we're asking the staff to do to fit the available workforce. It's also true on the faculty side that we're not hiring faculty to replace whatever turnover we have at the usual rate, and we have fewer non-tenure-track faculty. I always forget how much, but we have fewer than we did before, and we have, if anything, a few more students. So everybody is being asked to shoulder a load that hasn't been adjusted to what's been going on. It is true, it's obviously true, no sense pretending it's not, that theater, film, and dance has been given a big financial correction to make. I don't think the word devastating is correct. I think that's an exaggeration. I think that's hyperbolic. I do think it's a big one. I think the way it's been laid out is that the department itself has to figure out a way to do the most important things they do for less cost. The deans, I know for sure, and department head, have looked at how other departments work around the Ivy League and peer institutions. And the department won't go away. The department will not be crippled. But things are going to be different. And I'm, like everybody else, very curious to see what the suggestions are that the department leadership comes up with that are shared with the deans and see where it goes. So the bottom line is two things. We have to acknowledge that these are large cuts being requested. I don't think words like devastating and so on, or we're walking away, as you're implying, walking away from the arts and humanities. I don't think there's evidence to suggest that that's the case, but a lot of things are changing. And I'm not comparing this, but I do want to just point out, I'm not comparing this to the fate of losing staff jobs or changing the way things are done, but at the very beginning of this process, I eliminated two vice presidencies from the university and redistributed that work. So very substantial changes are occurring throughout the university, and this is one of them. But I will not walk away from the continuing focus on the arts and humanities.
Okay. So the, kind of on the, just really quick, does having less tenured faculty save us money? Is that the object of that?
No. It's just that the of course, every time you have fewer employees, you save money. But the object of hiring at a slower pace is because at the beginning of the recession, we realized that we had commitments that we made for which we didn't have guaranteed sources of revenue going into the future. We were facing what would have turned into an over $200 million deficit in the university. And eventually, those deficits would keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger because they were being financed by borrowed money. Mm-hmm. And you have to pay not only the money back, but the interest. Mm-hmm. And like every family, like every business, you have two choices when that happens. Forgive me, it's such a simple-minded answer, but I always remind myself of this, if it's your family or a business or you're teaching your child how to manage money, if you fall short of what you need, there's two things you can do. You can go get another job or somehow increase revenue. And what higher education has always done is increase tuition rapidly to make up for that. And we didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to do that anymore. We did raise tuition, but not as much as we normally did. And then the other way is to cut expenditures. Mm-hmm. And so that's the main way that this is being approached, is by trying to reduce expenditures. On the faculty hiring side, postponing faculty hiring in the year in which you would have spent that money, then the unfilled faculty line, those are revenues that can be used for something else. long term, if we don't have a supported workforce, both on the faculty and staff side, there won't be any university. No number of glitzy new buildings is going to make up for the lack of the human capital that really runs the university. In the beginning of the recession, all those things were treated harshly. Stop building buildings, we didn't give raises to people, we had layoffs among the staff, we had this generous and effective staff retirement incentive program that Mary designed, and then we had layoffs, and then we also stopped hiring faculty at the normal rate. All those things cannot continue. So with Mary's leadership, there's going to be a SIP this year, faculty and staff, the same SIP. There's going to be some more hiring of faculty toward the end of the year. There's going to be a tailing off in the layoffs, and there'll be fewer job actions than we had feared. And we'll begin to get back to equilibrium. But in the meantime, we put the place at risk, right? We put the place in peril by not having a robust workforce, and once again, as Mary points out, by not optimally matching the work to be done with the number of hands on deck to do it. So it's been tough. And if you look at the peer schools and what they've done, the general approach to things has been about the same. People gave lower raises or no raises. People slowed down construction and so on. But going forward, the difference at Cornell is that because of leadership, we're trying to rationalize the match between priorities and where the money is spent, the point of the strategic plan. And we're not there yet. Does it answer a little
bit? Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to combine two questions here. So you've touched on, the liberal arts. Liberal arts is still going to maintain a focus at Cornell.
For sure.
Okay. I'm not completely sure of the context of this question, but the recent information regarding the fate of the Russian department, there continues to be a problem with how cuts are being relayed to departments and their personnel. Have there been any substantive meetings with deans to address handling these situations better, letting those departments and employees know of major changes?
So I think there's two questions embedded in it, as I read it last night. Tell me first if I'm hearing this right, and I'll tell you my answer. So one question is the actual decision of what's happening with Russia, and from your comment on that. And the other question is, how's this being discussed before the decisions are made, or how's it being communicated? I think those are the two questions embedded.
That's my question.
So, yeah. So on the first one, just to make a comment about the first one. Hey, Leah. Don't worry, coming in late in the middle of my talk. I'm used to it from you. Anyway, it's good to see you. The issue of the languages, language offerings, Cornell has enormous language offerings. When I first came here, I counted them up. I forgot what it was, but something like 40 languages were being offered. Is that right? And it's good. This is a very comprehensive university. Students' interest in languages rises and falls, and the need out there for people to have fluency and facility with languages rises and falls. So, for example, when I was, I grew up in Los Angeles and started my college career at UCLA, anything related to Latino culture, Latina culture, and Spanish and so on was huge. It's even bigger now. Mm-hmm. Also, in those days in the Cold War, Russian and Russian studies were absolutely tops. Then things went on, the world evolved. It was always important to have Russian studies. My dad was born in Western Russia. He spoke Russian at home when I was a kid. But other things supervened. Now there's a lot of emphasis on Mandarin, Arabic, Hindi, other languages. We have a group, my poor guy who's stuck with teaching the Arabic, Mentor Yunus, I have the Arabic program, is a group of students in Jordan. For as part of the new intensive Arabic studies program. I know because as he was getting me ready for my comments in Qatar, we were emailing back and forth to Jordan. He was probably laughing at the language and stuff. But anyway, so the first point is that priorities change in terms of languages, including student demand. There's always going to be a need for strength in Slavic studies areas, and separate, I'm not pretending that none of this is related to the budget, but separate of the budget, there have been discussions in arts and sciences and elsewhere around the country about how to bundle those kinds of things. If you're going to study about an international culture, like I'm just learning about the Islamic culture in the Middle East, you can't only separate out, you know, what's the language that people speak. But there's many other cultural aspects having to do with the way the government works and ethics and legal things and so on. And the discussions that are going on, and I'm not privy to the details of them, have to do with thinking more broadly about Slavic studies. It is also true, that the specific investment in individual language areas has got to evolve as the demand evolves. But nobody's talking about not teaching Russian or anything like that. The bigger issue that I think you're asking about, which is hugely important, it's what I'm doing sitting here with you today, has to do with communication, which has to do with listening first, and then making decisions, and then talking. And of course, we haven't done as good a job, any of us, starting with me, as we could have done in communicating these things. And Mary will affirm, I think, she won't affirm that we're doing a great job, but she'll affirm that I talk about it and ask about it, and I'm concerned about it all the time, about the communications piece. And so we do need to work harder and harder on finding the sweet spot, the right point in which there's real consultation and people feel and believe that there's consultation, but yet decisions have to be made. And then once they're made, to be communicated in a way that's reasonable and considerate of people's feelings and fears and so on. And if you say that this wasn't communicated adequately, then that means it wasn't communicated adequately because the audience is what matters, the people receiving the message. I don't think it was because people didn't care about getting input or anything like that. And I have, not based on this question that I just got yesterday or a couple days ago, but based on earlier concerns about such things, I have talked a lot with the provost and the deans and the VPs about this.
Offer a thought.
Absolutely, that'd be great.
What I think many of us have felt and discussed in some of the other meetings we've had is that I think on the higher administration level, there's been a very concerted effort to communicate what's going on around the university, what's going on in a bigger picture way. But I think the thing that many of us find kind of distressing is when you get down to the more departmental level, mm-hmm. there's been a big breakdown within departments. And I'm speaking for theater, film, and dance.
Yeah,
but I think there's been a breakdown in terms of the quality of communication, transparency, all those aspects.
Well, I'll pass along your feeling about that personally to the people involved.
So I don't want to speak about theater film and dance because I don't have any information specifically about that one, but I will say that sometimes, though not, because I really don't have detailed information about any specific department, but what I have found is that sometimes what in particular staff feel or even faculty not involved in the first round of communication are impacted by are issues that are happening in the first round communication, disputes occurring in the conversations that start right at the departmental leadership that fracture that first set of communication. So by the time communication should be going out in with transparency so that people are getting information openly and with the ability to then give their voice to their own views, there's already perspectives having been driven into that first set of communication. So people are already getting fragments of information when they should be getting an opportunity for input. And that, by the way, isn't about academic departments. That's about any departmental communication. And my experience is that the higher up you are in communication, the easier it is actually to communicate because you're communicating at a lofty level.
Right.
So you can say things almost with a level of sort of at a value base. So you can say it, and it doesn't have any personalized nature to it. And then the closer you get to how it impacts you or the people you know, the more difficult it is to keep the conversation open for input because the more it starts to infect yourself and people you know. And the harder it is actually to keep your ears open and be really transparent in the communication. So I think that's where it takes real help in getting that two-way communication that stays two-way.
I guess what I would just offer is the more you folks in your position can say this is crucially important at all levels, and just continue to stress the need for open lines of communication, and that in all departments people keep doing that.
I try to. Mary does it. Mary does it very, very effectively. Point out something else about the an unusual thing about shared governance in the three places that I've been involved in shared governance, and it's definitely true at Cornell. There's pretty good dialogue at the central level in terms of shared governance. Mary interacts with you guys all the time. I interact with you periodically. I interact with the UFC. I interact with the SA, with the GPSA. But because there's only 24 hours in a day and only so many people who can do this, there's very little penetration in that sense to sort of what you might call local shared governance. When you start breaking the place down into smaller units, it's not like you have a little junior EA or junior SA or junior UFC at the departmental, at the collegiate, let alone the departmental level. And that's another corollary to what Mary's saying. Because this, you're bringing me in here to ask me questions. I take it very seriously. So does Mary. And you're putting a lot of effort into finding people who are willing to put all this time in, especially staff, at the central level. But we don't have a sort of a local shared governance system. And I used to talk about that a lot when I was at Iowa. And Mary and I talked about it when I first came here. And it's pretty hard to do. But that's a piece of it too, right? Is that we can sit down together and we, you know, respect each other and it's at a certain high level. The conversation is lofty, like Mary says. But it's also an organization that has gravitas and continuity. And like in most universities, it's uneven how things work in individual units. I'm sure there's units around where people feel they're being communicated with better than others, but it's uneven. And so, to whatever extent you can help as well from your point of view,
well, I think
that would be great.
I think with our planned restructuring of the EA and really focusing on getting an individual EA representative per unit, we can bring together what our departments share, but our departments don't represent the whole university because other departments are left out. So hopefully maybe a lot of more communication flowing to local departments up to the EA and beyond will occur in our new model.
In the meantime, I'll take the message back yet again.
So you did say that there will be a SIP this year. To add on to that, how does that compare to the faculty raise pool? So we've heard of the doing less with less, and as more staff cuts continue, how will university and department leaders, and probably more so down at the department level where the trenches are, is how will that roll out to staff, and is there any timeline? I mean, we we like to understand doing less with less, but sometimes the department local leaders not quite buying into that, and you know, you eliminate a position, okay, you get all the work. So
I'm not a big fan of doing less with less as a term because it's just jargon, and so David and I wrestle about that. Only because the person who gets a stack of stuff in the inbox doesn't have any idea which 3 inches of paper not to do. So the leadership has to do plans that align with the number of people still left in the department. So it's the leadership planning that has to align the work with the number of people still left in the department. So it's leaders who have to plan. The alignment is in the planning. And then the people do an equal amount of work with the number of people in the organization.
I know it's exactly right, but I want to be very, very...
Either that or just do any 3 inches you can get done in a day.
No, but this is actually a point. I want to be really, really, really blunt about it. The worst example of this in the whole university is sitting right to your left now. because I think it's accurate. No, in other words, what has occurred to you, what has been done. So Mary has got something like twice the number of people reporting to her as before the change, something like that. And she's doing all the stuff she used to do, plus all the new stuff, because I eliminated vice presidencies. I picked up some of it. She picked up some of it. Helped me.
Joanne
picked up some of it. And, those are the main three people. So, we're not very good at doing this, deciding. And in these cases, there's no 3 inches. All the stuff needs to be done, and that's the same thing that you're experiencing. There is a couple of areas in the university through this discussion that we've been having with Bain and company, where, and we've announced it, where we're trying to change the way things are done to have a better, more thoughtful match. It's sort of the exception, but there are a couple of examples of it. So, for example, the way facilities discussions are going, and we're in a different phase now. We're not having as many brand new projects go online and so on. And there's a concerted, focused effort to try to sort of line those things up better. To some extent, that's happening in IT. To some extent, that's happening in a couple other areas. But in general, across the university, the only honest statement is that we have fewer people doing still pretty much the same amount of work, and in some areas, fewer people doing more work, because they're doing all the normal equilibrium stuff they were doing, plus they're doing planning to kind of get the shift right, and that's a good example of what Mary is dealing with. So we haven't gotten there yet. It is true, though, that we have fewer resources to throw at things now. And in some areas, we're beginning to do a little bit less. But it's not a great phrase. And some people are actually doing more with less. Many are just doing the same with less. I think that's more of a general concept. And we haven't yet come to a decision. Now, in the local discussions that are happening at department, even in sub-departmental areas, only the people who work at that level can figure out what needs to be done to get through the day. But the leadership at every level has to deal with that. Every level, not just the VP for HR and the president, but at every single level, the deans, the department chairs, direct supervisors, and so on. And we're not that far along yet in all of these processes. The first things we did were very blunt and across the board, where nobody got raises, everybody got a 4.9% cut, and so on. Then this last 16 months, we've been working in many different venues that you guys have participated in, a lot of them, to try to figure out how to more specifically look at areas. And some of that really hurts, like the theater, film, and dance thing and all these things. That's an example of focusing on particular areas as opposed to just saying everybody take the same fair share, because it ends up not being fair because it's not really strategic. And then the last piece of it will be, once all that is figured out, that is, what are we going to do, what are we going to emphasize, what are we going to de-emphasize, and what are we going to stop doing, will the balance between available people to do the work, predominantly staff but also faculty to some extent, will it match up in a reasonable, humanly sustainable way with the work that is to be done? And we haven't got that figured out yet. The most eloquent spokesperson about that is Mary, and she knows about that from the point of view of being a workplace professional, but also from what she herself is going through in a leadership position. And so there's a lot of pressure on all of us to get better in that regard. But what's happening right now is we still have all these obligations that people are expecting, all the students expecting, all the classes to be taught, to get the degrees, to have services delivered to them for support, the faculty, the same grants, the same contracts where we signed and agreed to do the work. Some of that stuff is externally funded and people have their own money, some is not. And then all the administrative, even if it's being done externally funded, all the staff members who are doing everything from regulatory compliance for animals, humans, radiation protection, environmental protection, you name it, are doing all that work, and there's fewer of them in general around the whole campus, especially people who are doing multiple jobs in local areas. So it's a real big problem, and we haven't solved it yet.
I'm from the CPSA. I'm a student. Can I just ask
you?
And all of us look old and tired.
Well, I look in the mirror every day.
Is there a mechanism to get feedback on when cuts are affecting things? For example, you mentioned regulatory compliance. If a lab is being set up and says, we want to set up a radiological laboratory so we know we need to be compliant, and the health and EH&S people come back and say, this isn't something that happened, but just an example I'm making up. If they say, we don't have the support to support, or we don't have the staff to support that right now, the lab can't happen.
Yes.
Is there a feedback mechanism so you're aware of when things like that are happening? How does the lab get transmitted back?
the only way to be able to do that now is up through the hierarchical chain to the vice president that has that area. We don't actually have, or through ethics point, and that's actually not a bad way to do it either, because that's the ethics point is the fastest way to call, because in that case, compliance would say that could be a risk to the institution, that you're trying to set up a lab. We have compliance-related reasons because we took money from the government to get that lab set up in a particular amount of time. You could call that into the hotline.
I guess I just, in a more general sense, for other staff resources, you know, if it's IT support,
you could use up through the chain, through the hierarchical chain, and if you got nowhere, then I think you'd probably, you know, call it up through the governance process. That's one of the nice things about the governance process.
Can I also add one thing to what Mary said? Mary said the most important stuff. I want to add one more point. Since the job, you know, when you get overhead and grants, which is called FM, Facilities Administrative Costs, the administrative costs were capped some years ago at a certain level. Even if the costs of performing administrative duties, the staff duties, continue to go up, the amount the government pays for is capped at a level that's easily demonstrable to not cover the need. And so what universities have done is try to play catch up every year, grant by grant, every year. And of course, we spend more money to do it. I think we have good compliance mechanisms here. But they're always playing catch up because the faculty and students are encouraged to go get more grants. The grants come with a need. The more staff work to do the regulatory compliance, the government has capped the reimbursement. So it's predictable that there's going to be a growing gap between the resources brought from the federal government to pay for staff work to do on the one hand, and the need to get the work done by the growing amount of research that we're actually encouraging. So to follow what I'm saying,
right,
we're encouraging students and staff and faculty to write grants, knowing that we're growing the gap between the resources coming in to do it and the work that has to be done. So some money has been pumped into it, not from the government, but from other sources to do it. But there's always a tension, and there's always a gap there.
So there comes a point that...
That's the question you're asking. Do you ever come to a point where you walk away and refuse to take a grant?
Right.
And it rarely happens, there's no sense thinking about it, rarely happens, because what we're doing then is stepping on the prerogatives of individual investigator or students, a training grant or something to get through their career. But eventually, for big, huge things, we do occasionally walk away from something. But unfortunately, for the individuals suffering in this, both the principal investigator and the staff being the support, on the smaller grants, it doesn't rise to the level that Mary's talking about, where somebody would say, let's say somebody wanted to do a project, or it was a $500 million project, and it's a major thing, very, very visible. You know there'd be pressure to make sure that the appropriate stuff is covered. But on smaller things all over the campus every day, there's areas where you don't quite have the resources, or sometimes fall a lot short, to do regulatory compliance in all kinds of areas of the university, all kinds of areas. And so there's a big tension. The lab is one, but there's other ones that have to do with safety on campus and so on. And so it's a big area of tension. And so far, we have not systematically walked away from accepting grants. We have to pump more resources into it as much as we possibly can, or cut those areas less.
So you're talking about, when you say the resources, you mean those university resources that are filling that gap. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Okay. And you know, university resources need the money you decide to spend here instead of spending there. Mm-hmm. And where those resources, where the rubber meets the road, are staff working to do the regulatory compliance. Now, on the other hand, you have to be very careful to start walking away from those resources, not so much for the money that goes to the investigator, which of course is critical, but because you're limiting, especially for grad students and postdocs, they're limiting their forward motion to do things. Because you know how it is, part of your career is not only based on learning the stuff, and learning how to write and so on and so forth, it's having the notches on your belt, so to speak, that you write a grant, the grant gets funded, and then somebody has confidence, well, maybe if we hire them, they'll continue to write grants and they'll be successful, and unless you can show the success. So the pressure from your side, so to speak, will be enormous. Don't get in my way. The pressure from worrying about the staff workload from here is going to be, let's make sure that we can do what we promised we're going to do. And the ethics part is that we take the money with the promise, and it's the right thing to do, the promise that we're going to protect the public and do all the right things.
there's a three-way tension. Cornell does it a lot better than a lot of other schools because it does have other resources to do it and because it's a huge research operation, but it's not perfect. Does that answer?
It does. Thank you.
So we're approaching 1 o'clock. Do you have somewhere you need to be next? Or can
if it means have a lot of our tough questions. Yeah,
I've got to summarize our two little quick questions here.
Let's zoom in 3 minutes.
Maybe, quick. Okay. The first one is there any statement on future layoffs? And I guess I would kind of phrase this is a lot of people have thought that layoffs were going to all come by the start of the fiscal year. And I've asked this question to Mary. She said that's not necessarily the case. It could be throughout the next year. I guess people are getting, and I just heard this from an employee today, that we're getting a little jitters because they said, oh, well, things were going to start happening in March. Now things are starting in April. Now it seems a little bit longer. People are all still just waiting.
Yeah.
I guess people want to know if it's still coming, and we know it is, when? And I've also told people today, as I know, then it's not going to come in just one big wave, and all the layoffs across the university are going to be announced in one day. There's going to be little pockets released here or there as the departments make these decisions.
Just a couple general things I'd like to refer to Mary. The one thing is, I don't mean just to be the Mary Opperman show, but because of Mary's advocacy.
Depends on what the show is.
Because of Mary's advocacy and the force of her focus, we have stepped back from as many job actions as might have originally been anticipated. Because any organization where most of the revenue goes to pay salaries, the initial temptation is to just balance the budget completely based on job actions. And because of Mary's advocacy, and I've supported that advocacy as strongly as I could, but it's her advocacy, there will be fewer job actions than I originally feared there would be. I think we might as well just say that because it's absolutely true. But there will be some job actions. There will be vacant positions that will not be filled, and there'll be some layoffs. And we're about to announce the order of magnitude of that in, what's an honest answer, a couple of weeks?
At the most,
a couple of weeks. And I think it'll be in the form of a communication from the provost to the campus. Is that right?
I haven't seen you swear.
Me too. But it'll be from one of these offices in this building. And so it has been a very long time. It is very uncertain. That's what I said at the beginning. But the number of job actions fewer than I feared they would be, and the announcement about the. But it is exactly right what you said, Jason. It's not going to be this exact number on one day, and that's the end of it. But the order of magnitude, the sort of approximate size, people will know pretty soon.
And finally, so
the machine is being
well. Let me say that we've had about 25% more layoffs in the downturn. Each year has been about 25% greater than our regular layoffs, and that I do not expect next year to be any higher than that. So we don't have an enormous number of layoffs coming next year. We don't have some massive number of layoffs coming. I don't think next year will be any worse than last year or the year before. The one unknown is this New York State cut. Yeah. We always have that dangling. So there are two reasons why I've been hesitant to say anything. One is New York State. And the other is that when you lay off one person, as far as I'm concerned, that makes it a bad year. And so when I'm just not the kind of person that can walk around celebrating the fact that you didn't lay off very many people when people lose their jobs. If you're the one person or one of 10 or 20 that lost their jobs, it was a lousy year. So for me, it's hard to say, gosh, we should all feel really good because only 50 people lost their jobs. If you're in the family of the person who's in that 50, it was a lousy year. And so I have to temper that fact with the fact that there's thousands of people who think that number's going to be enormous.
Exactly.
And so I'm getting myself there. I do not think FY11 is going to be even as bad as FY10 was. We are rounding the corner to seeing our way through, with the one caveat remaining that New York State, I'm afraid, New York State looks just sad. And that we are a captive to what New York State hasn't been able to figure out. And we have four colleges, that's a lot of people. So with that one caveat, and with our own fact that you can't call yourself a caring community, know that there are people who will lose their jobs and then walk around in major celebration if there are people who will. Recognizing that, I think that we are about at the end of our downturn, and I don't see a big number in FY11.
And one other thing I would just remind you of an earlier question and earlier comment Mary made, two questions, is that when it's in equilibrium and everything's all set, relative equilibrium, we're always having layoffs, we're always having hirings, still there's this issue of lining up the amount of work and the type of work with the available workforce that hasn't been solved yet, which is a separate issue. But when we get to this point where we sort of hit the thing and we're at or close to the end of it, then we have to work on this other issue, because in the aggregate, 25%, 25%, there's fewer people on deck and there's a lot of work going on. More grants, regulatory compliance, you name it. It's got to be real clear.
Okay. So the task force reports from the provost, have you received all of them now? Are they all in?
Everything that I've seen in the task force is on the web and you've seen.
Okay.
The provost has decided 19 of the 20 exactly what to do. Forget about this one, implement this one, and assign a group to do it, or still think about it. The 20th one is the budget model. They're still talking about the implementation of the budget model. The strategic plan, just to round out the question, the strategic plan itself is done now, and they're just putting the final grammatical touches on it. The input was very, very, very helpful and changed it. As Mary points out, I think this is a very important thing to celebrate. That 100% faculty group had a whole flank on staff and staff employees, which was great.
My only suggestion is that as...
But three. I just want to cover all three. Okay. And the last one are the things that are related to the administrative restructuring through Bain. Those ones have gone on the web as we've decided to do them. So procurement we decided to do them, we had a big discussion about that. And the other major ones have to do with all, just think of the administrative offices, the people around the table have to do with finance, HR, facilities, IT, and so on. And we're very close to announcing those now, all of those. But it's okay. Important that we cover all three sets of parameters, because all three of those sets of parameters will affect staff. Most of the staff are in the colleges, and so those academic task forces will directly or indirectly affect at least the balance between available workforce.
I'm concerned in anticipating the release of some of those reports and then any comment from staff at large that just was not part of any of the planning process, that there is a period of comment to...
On the administrative areas that were worked on by Bain, we never intended to have broad... town hall meetings about the details of how something was going to be done. But the way those teams were put together, an administrative person, a dean, a college officer together sponsored reviews of those things. And I don't want to be dishonest to you, there's no period coming up where we're going to say in the facilities we're thinking of doing this and the university community has 60 days to comment on it. That's not going to happen. Those decisions have been made. They're going to be announced. Now, all those decisions together is within what Mary just talked about when she said there's been about a 25% increment in the normal churn of layoffs on campus, and she doesn't expect that to be out of the ordinary. She even said it might be even less than fiscal 11 than it was in fiscal 10. That's including all the stuff that we're talking about. That's including all those things that are going to be announced. As long as she's talking about that, and then all of a sudden some other axe is going to fall. This is including her knowledge of all those areas, and she's been at all the discussions. Is that clear, though?
Yep.
Okay. I got to go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we don't have a ceremonial thing when we leave that our name things go down.
I want to know why mine is the only one that takes this way, though.
Because you're lucky.
Because I've been here so long.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
come and join us.
Okay. My chair.
Yeah, jump up there. Come on.
Come on, Ben.
All right. Okay, so moving on, I didn't get to put in this call for late additions to the agenda. We're adding under business of the day the resolution for executive vice chair responsibility reallocation. I thought we were going to do some more polishing of this, and I think at this point maybe it is as polished as it's going to get, unless anybody has any grammatical changes. I'd like to change that this is going to be submitted by David Brooks, vice chair of the Employee Assembly. David was the... We announced this a week in advance of this meeting.
Yeah, it has to be voted on at a different meeting from the one that's been.
We weren't under that assumption. We introduced the language a week ahead, saying that we would vote on it at this meeting as a charter change.
Can we talk about it last meeting?
Yeah. I'm just saying
what
I said. But that didn't come up at the last meeting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What did it come
it
up?
It wasn't. The challenge
maybe
didn't come
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
That's all new. That wasn't mentioned at the last mm-hmm. meeting. All right.
With the resolution?
There was discussion about separating the duties and that we would put together a resolution that Jason submitted last Wednesday to the group via email, and that we would vote on it
at this meeting.
So we would have had to put ahead the resolution at the last meeting?
Yeah. The wording.
Yeah, I think so. Wording.
But were you at the last
meeting? Yeah, you were at the last meeting.
Yeah, but
I would just speak to what I think the spirit of the rule here is, that a charter change doesn't catch any employee assembly member by surprise, and that everybody has the due notice of at least a week's notice prior to the meeting.
Does anyone
that
not
help?
Want to vote on this today?
So, Ari, I think this is meeting the spirit of the charter provision. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In our last official meeting, would that be an official parliamentary rule, Mr. Parliamentarian?
It's the one and only ruling I've made.
Okay. I guess we should all read this verbatim, and if you have any questions, David and I can address them. Yes, I'll read it out loud. Whereas the Employee Assembly Executive Vice Chair position is currently held accountable for maintaining multiple positions and responsibilities, such as Executive Vice Chair of the Employee Assembly, Chair of the Employee Assembly Executive Committee, paw print board member, leadership breakfast member, and attends regular meetings with the Vice President of Human Resources. Whereas the Employee Assembly is working towards expanding its current number of members to a ratio that improves the representation of the Cornell staff population, be it resolved that the position of Employee Assembly Vice Chair be separated into the following positions and consequent responsibilities: the Executive Vice Chair of the Employee Assembly and Communications Committee Chair. Be it further resolved that Section 4.3.3 of the Employee Assembly Charter be amended to remove serves as Chair of the Communications Committee, and Section 6.4 amended to remove the Executive Vice Chair of the Assembly who serves as Chair of the Committee, and one other voting member of the Assembly to be replaced with two members of the Assembly, one of whom serves as Chair and renumbered accordingly. In all technicality, essentially all this is removing the by-charter definition that the Vice Chair is the Chair of the Communications Committee.
Can I just
yep.
make one quick comment? The paw print board member piece of it would seem to me that piece is very tied to the communications chair piece.
Mm-hmm. So if we're going to remove that, maybe, no?
That would stay with communications chair.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Which,
yeah,
I
that
think
would
I be had that in the original language. But
yeah, I think it needs to be together because I think that's the tie-in.
Yeah, leadership breakfast meetings with Mary and the executive committee would all still be the
perfect
vice chair.
Right.
And it would really just be communications chair
and the
proper
board. Yeah, I
just
wanted to make sure they went together. That's all.
Absolutely.
Yep. Other than that, I'm fine.
Wait, I'm confused because it says here that Paul Print board member will stay with the existing vice chair.
It shouldn't.
It's the communications. It's the
chair.
Main employee communications.
Okay,
right?
Then we need to.
I don't think
we need to strike that, but I don't think we need to necessarily add it. I don't think the charter mentions the Paul Print membership.
Okay.
So what we would do is strike in the first paragraph, fourth line, Paul Print board member. Strike that out. It doesn't belong in this wording, and it's not explicitly, I think, in the charter. I mean, we could look it up if anyone has a big concern. Essentially, it's...
I actually think it's kind of important to leave it out because that's opening up a can of worms of other sort of possible...
Well, you know what? I'm not really sure if there is still a Paul Print board.
It doesn't... I don't think it exists anymore.
So
yeah.
That might not even be an issue.
Yeah.
I mean, actually,
yeah.
The
yeah.
Right
just
so
yeah.
Can include them.
No,
they
yeah.
Board
yeah.
Members.
Yeah.
No. I think
oh, wait, you know what?
That was a big discussion.
Yeah. Well, I work two doors
yeah.
down.
Yeah.
Down
I still think it's
going to
be a
the editor board.
It could be
a
Paul Print
board.
The board is. I think the board is gone.
Okay. It doesn't matter. But someone make a motion
it,
before
yeah.
we beat this thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
If you could discuss, I'm cool with it.
Yeah, it's true. We should. Is there a motion first before discussion?
I'll make a motion.
Okay.
Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we adopt this. Now we can go into discussion. No problem. So on second thought, that scratching out the Paul Print board member was really detailing what the existing vice chair does.
Mm-hmm.
So although it's not mentioned in their charter, it actually could stay or be removed. It really means the same thing. It's basically saying, have been a vice chair as well, there are, it seems like an extra amount of meeting responsibilities on the vice chair in general. So separating it one of the responsibilities out a little bit could help reduce the load a little bit.
Well, a lot of it for me was that I really felt that the communications committee really suffered this year because it was just me trying to juggle all these things. And with two separate people, you know, vice chair and communications chair, I just think it's going to serve the EA much, much better.
You're kind of holding the five or six positions in here.
This is a summary of some of them. It's not designed to be exclusive. It's just
all inclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a sample.
Yeah.
But the board is gone.
Is there any other discussion on this? Any other questions, comments?
We're going to
wait for Gary here
a
second. Okay.
There is no
conference.
Oh,
really?
We told you that,
yeah,
Gary.
It's been dissolved.
Wait a minute. Notice the record, Gary.
You know how I know that? You know how I know that? You know how I know it? Because I was a member of that board. That's how. It's gone. It's over.
A couple months
and
ago.
And he knew it too. He knew it too.
Yeah,
there was an email about it. I was a member of that board, and I got rid of it.
I stand corrected.
Now you may sit.
Thank you.
Okay, because this is a charter change, I'm going to do a roll call vote. So, is there any other discussion? Okay.
ready for a vote. Okay. David Brooks, yay or nay?
Yay.
Pempa Dantau?
Yay.
Yay. Tanya Grove?
Yippee.
Yippee. Linda Kroll Howell?
Yay.
Leon Lawrence?
Present. Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Leslie Morris.
Yeah, good.
Gemma Osborne.
Yay.
Oh. Tim Ostrander.
Yay.
Stevie Phillips.
Yay.
I will vote yay. Gary Stewart.
Yep.
There are no abstentions. There's no objections. The resolution passes. 11 yays. 11 present board members. 0 noes. 0 abstain. Thank you very much. I will submit this to the president in accordance with our charter changes. I can't imagine him having a serious problem with this, but if he did, the new EA term will have to fix it. All right, thank you very much. Moving on to report from employee elected trustee. We'll kind of table that to see if Beth is able to pop in. Report from UA representative?
No report.
No report. Report from GPSA?
No report.
Well, you guys are still on vacation, right? Report from the faculty senate liaison? Wait, Alan. EA finance update. Look at final or new budget projections will probably be at the next meeting.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I know. Let's skip into approval of the minutes first. Let's have a moment here to review the May 5th meeting minutes. And after a minute or so, I'll entertain a motion. Is there a motion?
Come on, Leon, one more time, buddy.
All right. I so move. I'm motion.
He so motion moves.
Yeah.
Second. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Abstain? Minutes passed. Thank you very much. Well, as we wind down here in the last 9 minutes of the last meeting of the 2009-2010 term, I would like to thank you all for your service on the Employee Assembly, especially to our outgoing members who will be leaving us. Leon will be leaving us, Tim, Ned, Alan.
I just want to say, when I started, I actually had an afro.
Can you bring that back?
No, it's gone.
Oh.
Did you really see it being a part of it?
Yeah. No, I'm only kidding.
And I'd like to thank you for your confidence in electing me chair over this year. It's been quite a challenging and exciting and ever-moving target year. It's definitely not what I was expecting for the year as chair, but you know, sometimes in a big university, you don't know what you're going to see on the seas of the hard-to-steer ocean liner. This is a nice analogy I like to put out there, that you know, the ocean liner is big and beautiful, and you can do all sorts of cool things with it, but you can't just turn right immediately. You have to plan for the turn, and a lot of people have to be involved in making that turn happen, and the EA is definitely a component of that turn, and I think we've had a very good year of leadership from the executive team and all members. We are really cleaning up what the EA is doing and how we're going to do it in the future. The expansion of the EA, I think, is going to be a wonderful thing. I look forward to helping out with that still in the next 2 years, or, well, 1 year as we try to get it implemented. So, that's it. Thank you very much, everybody. So, moving on to committee reports, we're going to keep these kind of short because we need to have some room for officer nominations. Executive committee?
We didn't meet last week. There was no meeting.
Staff recognition and awards?
Nothing to report.
Communications?
We have that. Okay.
Personnel policy?
We met, and one thing that's kind of neat is we now have two members of organizational effectiveness that have joined our team that are looking at the flex work policy because we feel it's very tied into career development.
Cool. Awesome.
Judy Moran.
Yep. Let me skip. Okay, university benefits is completely on our sort of hiatus. Employee education?
Nothing to report.
Okay.
I did send out, though, a link. I sent it on the EA for checkbox, I think it's called, if you're interested in the survey.
Got that.
Okay. Make sure you have that.
Okay. So we'll go back to internal operations. Is there anything to report besides the nominations?
Just one thing. Ned has agreed that he would like to be on the UA. So if no one has any objection, we can appoint him for next year's term, and then we'll be that much closer to the fully staffed.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Mm-hmm. No objection. It's a great move.
All right.
Thank you.
There we go. Another one.
Great. So just a quick, so we open up the floor to nominations now for your...
Yeah, I have a question about that. I don't think we should be doing that at this meeting. I mean, we don't have the new EA here. And so there's people here who aren't here who potentially could be on the executive committee, and I don't think it's fair to broach that at this time since we didn't invite them to come. I mean, obviously they're welcome, Leslie's here.
They've been added to the mailing list.
Okay. Yeah, but it wasn't like, yeah. I mean, did they know we're going to be doing nominations?
No. To clarify, I always felt this was kind of weird too. It's how it's always been. This doesn't close the nominations. The beginning of the first meeting, nominations are still open.
Then what do we get out of it?
Right now it's nothing. We just start the official nominations and people would get on the list.
Yeah, but it's next year's EA. It's not this year's EA. And I think it should just be clean from the get-go, and not like if Congress gets elected in November and there's 2 months between their election and then the new Congress being seated. The old Congress isn't like talking about who's going to be the Speaker of the House because the new Congress isn't in yet. And so I don't think it's a good idea to even go into it at all.
Any thoughts? I mean, I would say I personally thought it was also kind of weird that that's how it happened. I thought maybe it was explained at one time that, you know, the person nominated has a chance to reflect on whether they're prepared to take on the position if elected. Otherwise, it's all happening all at one meeting.
I have a question. Is there orientation for new members before the next full EA meeting? So if that's the case.
Oh,
There should be.
Yeah.
They would get a better idea of what it means, and then. I mean, I don't see any reason why we can't nominate and select people out at the next meeting, but it'd be nice if they had their orientation first.
Yeah, so they understood what the positions were.
Well, I would say if someone wanted to nominate, like if I wanted to nominate someone, I would want to have a conversation with them first before nominating them, just privately to say, I think you'd be good at this. Are you interested in being nominated, so they're not kind of taken off guard?
And I don't want those new EA guys coming in there and saying at their first meeting, oh, it's our last meeting, we were talking about who we're not, and that's how they're starting. It's important that everyone starts off on a good footing and feels good about the EA, that there's transparency from the get-go, and there's no kind of...
Ben, how does the GPSA do it?
The GPSA, the voting members are elected, and their first action is to elect their officers. And so the last meeting of the semester, we elect the newly seated members elect the officers for the following year. So I think the parallel would be this body is finishing up, so it would not elect new officers. And so when the new body is seated, they would elect the officers.
Do you elect your officers at your last meeting, though, of the term?
It's the last meeting of the term that the new voting members are seated. So the new voting members,
their first official meeting is the last meeting of the term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
that?
The stuff we left out.
It's different because there's more time to the academic
calendar. Okay.
Something that the SA does that maybe would be more analogous to what the script could do is they have an organizational meeting of the new members that happens outside of the regular meeting schedule. So at some point in April, even though the existing SA is still meeting, they'll have a meeting just the new members and they'll select their officers and positions.
Do you recall what our charter says about this process? I mean, okay.
I think the charter says that. I don't think that. The EA charter right now stipulates you have to do it one way or the other.
Okay.
The new assembly elects its own officer.
Okay. Well, the election is not occurring here today, so we don't have to formally accept any nominations today, or we say we can, and there kind of was none officially presented. You get the chance to present them at the next meeting. Leon, you're coming back?
No. I just want to say I agree with what Gary's saying. I mean, why not let them start off with a new, I mean, why should we, and like you said, too, we haven't spoken with anybody. How do you know, after they find out the details or the orientation, that they would even want to do it? So I just think it's a waste of time to do it now, but that's just me.
Well, previous years, it's just been, if there was any nominations, they were made, but there was no voting or anything. It was just carried over to the next meeting. If there were more, it was added. If there were no more, then acclamation. You're the only one that wants to be chair. You're it, kind of thing. So it's kind of cool. Anything you do today is fine.
Yeah. Okay, unless there's objection, is there any objection to moving this all to the first meeting?
I would just encourage people, if you want to nominate someone, to have a conversation with them about it beforehand, because speaking from personal experience,
for 10 seconds.
Yeah. So,
I can relate to that.
So, you know,
totally.
David and I
okay.
Walked out of the meeting and said,
"What
happened?"
All right, so we are out of time.
Do you think we could have a meeting like starting at 11 on June, whatever it is, June 2nd? And that could be like an orientation component?
We had already said that the meeting on the first meeting was going to be a longer meeting.
Right.
It was going to go till 2 because we have guests to arrive at that meeting.
Sorry, go ahead. A clarification. I'm looking at the charter. We did change this last year. There's supposed to be a new process for this year, which I...
Okay.
Doing more or less the same way, but it says there's supposed to be a separate organizational meeting before the last day of May of the new CA who elects the officer.
Oh. So we got to get that meeting scheduled.
Or it can just be the first meeting in June.
Yeah, that meeting in June is
was extended in time to fit that in there.
The nominations process that you're talking about, the language requiring that was eliminated in the charter overhaul last year. So.
Why are we having guests at that meeting? Why is that essential? Who is it, Opperman and Bishop?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And why?
That they were scheduled weeks in advance to get both of them to be able to attend a meeting, and that's the slot that first became available.
Why is it important that they're at that meeting?
I did not make the call for... There was interest in having further information about the layoffs and the layoff procedures and how those occur directly from the person that is in charge.
Yeah, Mary had suggested at one point
that
Well, then let's hope they're open and transparent, because I've never really gotten anything besides my vague, give us something. If you're gonna show up, give us some meat.
Right.
You know.
Well, they did say they were going to be announcing some more counter information within the next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so we have to wrap up. Is there any, I think we've covered a lot of Cornell in transition. Old business, new business, open forum, or I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Just very quickly, the 21st of June looks like a good date for the majority of people for the retreat. So put that in calendars and we'll plan it. If there's any thoughts or suggestions from people, but just one of the things that some of us have talked about is getting around the campus more on this campus, so we're going to try to arrange a van and do a little campus tour of some new buildings and things like that. And then possibly having Charlie Walcott, who is head of the UA, to come and talk with us just about how leadership at the assembly is coming up and stuff like that.
Yeah, and one other thing I'm hoping we can do is I'm doing this show called Staff Notes on Cornellcast, and so I want to take a little bit of the time that day, and for each new EA member, to give we'll have a crew over there to give 90 seconds about hi, I'm Tanya Grove, I'm the general manager at the Schwartz Center. I live in Shrewsbury. I'm involved in the EA because I think it's important. It's blank, and then we'll have this thing. We'll have this nice little 12 to 14 minute segment with all the EA members on it that we could put. That'll be on Cornellcast. We could put it on the EA website. So it's that's an actual thing that people can see who's on the EA, and they can say, I really hope that I receive input from you. Either issue, I'm interested in sustainability, blah, blah, blah. So that'll be part of that day, too.
Great idea, Gary.
But if there are other things that people would like to see us put into the retreat, let me know.
So the retreat we decided was the 21st of June.
The 21st of
June.
Yeah.
And the time for the
9 to 3.
Place to be
around.
Right.
Okay. Do you know where we want to have it?
We're trying to find somewhere on campus. Like the Passing Center was one place, or Aftonic Studies. But just somewhere outside of Day Hall, but elsewhere on campus. So if people have gone to meetings, places that are cool that could fit us, that you might want to suggest, that would be great.
I could. The place you did last year is not available, or you don't want to go off
at
campus
the,
anymore?
Chamber
of Commerce. Yeah.
We could. We have to pay for it.
Oh.
I mean, we could pay for it. We have the money. But that's a question, too. And we can talk about it if people have any thoughts. If the desire is to go off campus. I was just thinking if we were to do that campus tour, it would be nice to.
Is there anything else? No. We don't want to get too much into details of the retreat.
No.
We take it offline.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Yeah. Okay, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
1:36 p.m. Thank you very much, everybody, for your service to the Employee Assembly.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.